But it seems that if you look into the different power blocks that you're talking about, those running these ultra large corporations are completely different than those that are involved with, let's say, with the Dominionist Church.
Not really. Not really. That's I think where the connections come is follow the money. Who is funding? What is funding the rise of the media church and the Christian right? And what you find out is these are all the same people. I mean, it even can go back to the old John Birch Society. You know, Tim LaHaye now is known as this wonderful, or not wonderful, he's known as this author, co-author of this 65 million book bestseller, The Left Behind series. But Tim LaHaye is an old political operative from back in the John Birch days, and his Council on Foreign Policy brings together Christian right-wing dominionists, but it also brings together neoconservative thinkers. There is, behind the scenes, behind the appearances, there is very much a fusion of strategy between the corporate right, for sure, and political right, and the Christian right. We also see this in funding of institutions. For example, the Institute of Religion and Democracy is a primarily corporate-funded parachurch organization whose purpose is to undermine the social justice witness of mainline congregations that would speak out for social justice. So I think there is a direct correlation, and again, it's a story that needs to be told between where the money is and how the Christian evangelical and media church is being used.
Reverend Rich Lang and attorney Bill Hansen speaking with Mike McCormick about their forum, Fascism in America, held last week in Seattle. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. We'll conclude with Dr. Robert J. Lifton, who I referred to at the beginning of the program. Lifton has specialized in the study of the psychology of fanaticism and mass violence.
The following forum, Superpower Syndrome, America's Apocalyptic Confrontation with the World, was presented by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, on April 17, 2004. The featured speaker, Robert J. Lifton, is a distinguished scholar and author in the field of psychiatry. In this talk, he helps us understand 9/11 and the Bush response to it by putting them in the context of earlier episodes of apocalyptic violence. For many years, Dr. Lifton was distinguished professor of psychiatry and psychology at the City University of New York. Currently, he is visiting professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Robert J. Lifton.
I sometimes feel a bit sensitive when I walk into a room, because I know that given the draconian subjects that I've studied, people wonder, what horror will he bring to us next? I confess to a commitment to confronting our collective horrors, but I do so in a spirit of hope and with the possibility of achieving modest amounts of insight and therefore influencing our actions in some humane direction. And the principle here is looking into the abyss in order to see beyond it. You don't want to be stuck in the abyss, and yet you have to look at it if you're to understand our time. Any reflection of this kind must start with Iraq. Let me say in beginning, we've created an arena of violence in Iraq that threatens at any moment to become apocalyptic violence. We have two competing narratives in Iraq, as you know. One is that we are liberators, and the other is that we are occupiers. We've liberated people from a cruel dictator. That's narrative one. Narrative two, our invasion of Iraq makes us a foreign force there, creating an inevitable insurgency, and we're there in seeking to dominate the Middle East and the world in general. Of course, many Iraqis are relieved to be rid of Saddam Hussein, a murderous dictator. But yet they're deeply troubled by that second narrative, the American superpower seeking hegemony in dominating the Middle East by controlling Iraq. The truth is that the initial military victory was just the beginning of new and greater violence, and that's what we're in the middle of right now. And this violence suggests to me and to many others a beginning decline of the American superpower. One has to be aware, as I'm sure most people in this audience are, that this was not a necessary war. This was a war of choice. It's been understood to be that. It was not even a preemptive war. A preemptive war being one in which one responds to immediate preparations for war on the part of one's enemy. That wasn't the case at all. It really was a preventive war, a war initiated because our leaders decided that at some point in the future, Iraq was dangerous to American national security. But the doctrine of preventive war, always dangerous, becomes doubly so in the nuclear age. There are many in this audience who can remember the cries for preventive war against the Soviet Union during the course of the Cold War, and especially during the early emergence of nuclear weapons in then Soviet Russia. Fortunately, wiser counsel prevailed. We did not initiate that preventive war, but had we done so, hundreds of millions of people would have been killed. So preventive war is a particularly odious doctrine in the nuclear age. One would say that the American invasion of Iraq has not just created a credibility gap, but a reality gap. The deceptions and the lies in association with that invasion have come increasingly to the surface, and it's as if this administration has a sense of entitlement as part of what I call superpower syndrome, a sense of entitlement about telling lies, as though it has a higher purpose and a higher truth, which make that acceptable. Still, there is the drumbeat of American deaths in Iraq, and these have increased, as you know, and it's something increasingly the administration has to direct its attention to, however reluctant it is to do so. The way in which Americans in general respond to American deaths in Iraq is crucial, crucial for the outcome of the next election, crucial for what happens in Iraq and the world. There was an initial triumphalism, as you know, with the glorious surrounding the glorious victory. And with that triumphalism came a tone and an attitude that has hardly disappeared, namely to have reservations about, or certainly to oppose, the invasion of Iraq was to be unpatriotic or un-American. But what shows greater love for one's country, indeed, I would say, greater patriotism, than speaking out when one sees it taking a destructive and highly self-destructive course? So I consider my book and these remarks to be my form of patriotism. And much of the talk will be about how we reached the predicament that we're in right now. I believe there's a worldwide epidemic of apocalyptic violence, which is aimed at the destruction of some portion of the world in the service of renewing it. And it's apparent when one looks at the Islamist extremists and their overtly visionary willingness to kill for their religion. But it's less apparent and yet no less present in American forces claiming to be restrained and reasonable, but no less visionary in their projection of war-making and military power. I want to talk about past studies that I've done in terms of their relevance for our situation now. I do this in my book and in my work in general. The approach that I use is called psychohistorical, but what that means very simply is a psychological address or a psychological approach to historical problems. And this approach has been influenced by the work of Erik Erikson. I won't say much about it in detail, except to say that in applying it to large world events, to events of history, one has to modify the Freudian model of instinct and defense, and one needs a broader model of life and death, of the symbolization of life and the symbolization of death. And one also needs to recognize that we have two levels of our experience as human beings, of our psychological response. One of those levels is the immediate nitty-gritty level of looking at behavior, but the other is what I call a larger or ultimate level, the sense of larger human connectedness, and what I call the symbolization of immortality, the sense of living on in one's children and their children, or in one's works, one's human influences, or in some religious principle of an eternal soul, or in what's called in almost all cultures eternal nature, or else in some kind of psychic state so intense that is high states or the experience of transcendence, the classical mode of the mystics, so intense that within it time and death disappear. All this is necessary if one is to look at destructive events or really at larger events of human history in general. In my own work, I've been studying significant destructive events in the past, but they have been largely in the past. When we come to the present situation, one has to realize that we are still very much in 9/11. We don't speak of it. We can't speak of it as a past event. We are in it and feeling its reverberations every day as they affect us and as they are manipulated by the present administration. This presentness or ongoing quality makes our studies of 9/11 quite different from studying events that have already occurred. We are still struggling with 9/11 as survivors. Having said that, I want to suggest some of the themes in my earlier work that have bearing on our preoccupations today. The first study I did was of Chinese thought reform. I did it in the mid-50s when I was a very young psychiatrist, and it was a study of the Chinese coercive efforts at changing people. And I won't go into details about it, but I came to realize over time that Chinese thought reform, or so-called brainwashing, was really an apocalyptic projection of destroying all of the past, all of the mental past, in the service of creating a totally new future and purifying Chinese society. It was an effort at what I call ownership of the mind. Again, all of these themes are not unknown in our present dilemmas. My next study was that of Hiroshima survivors in 1962, and that led me to develop a psychology of survivors, but it also opened me and others, I think, to a recognition of the special psychological nature of the nuclear age. The weaponry itself is of such a dimension that it is apocalyptic, inherently apocalyptic. And this becomes, with that weaponry, the ownership of death, or the ownership of life and death. The weapons invite sacralization. That is, the weapons can do what in the past, in our minds, only God could do, destroy the world. and there's an impulse to connect the weapons with sacred purposes. Of course, there's nothing sacred about them. If one wants to talk of pure evil, one has the example in nuclear weapons. I did a study of Vietnam veterans in the early 1970s, and I learned a lot from that study, and it has a lot of bearing on what's going on in Iraq right now. I came upon the idea of what I called an atrocity-producing situation. What that meant, very simply, was that an ordinary GI, no better or worse than you or me, could walk into a structure that would cause him quickly to commit atrocities. It had to do with the structure of an anti-insurgency war and the psychology of being fearful and losing buddies and feeling one's life in danger and not being able to line up the enemy. That's the classic structure of a counterinsurgency struggle, and that could create the apocalyptic situation. An apocalyptic situation that was epitomized by that famous image, we had to destroy the village to save it. Destroying to save is the essence of the apocalyptic worldview. It was part of our then anti-communist crusade. And really, the Vietnam War is resurfacing, if that's the word. It's been reactivated in the minds of many, including the minds of Vietnam veterans, partly because of John Kerry having been a veteran and an opponent of that war, and partly because the experiences of those returning from Iraq reactivate the feelings experienced by Vietnam veterans, and in some degree, those of the rest of us who underwent that war as civilians. There was the psychology at that time of opposing one's own war while fighting it. And that kind of idea, interestingly enough and in a constructive way, has affected a group of Israeli reservists called the Courage to Refuse. And they see themselves as having been influenced by anti-war Vietnam veterans, and some of them have told me so, in refusing to fight in occupied territories in Israel. They will fight to defend their country, but not to be occupiers. And they have had reverberations throughout Israel and in other parts of the world. In the late 1970s and early 80s, I studied Nazi doctors, who represent a terrible reversal of healing and killing. It was really an apocalyptic biology as they sought to eliminate all bad genes in bad races, destructive races, quotes, such as the Jews particularly, but also Gypsies and Slavs and others. And what one learns, among other things, from that is that you cannot kill very large numbers of people except with a claim to virtue. The Nazis really felt they were purifying the world and improving the world by their policy of mass murder, killing to heal. By the time I studied Om Shinrikyo, the fanatical Japanese cult, which released sarin gas into the Tokyo subways in 1995, I was thinking about the apocalyptic tendencies involved. And let me say something now about what I mean by apocalyptic violence, because it's at the heart of our difficulty. Apocalyptic violence is more than ordinary violence. It's an impulse to destroy the world or a segment of the world in order to purify it. It's evoked in the book of Revelation, as you know, but there are suggestions of apocalyptic violence of this kind in the Old Testament, in the book of Daniel. And every major religion has some narrative of apocalyptic violence. a narrative of an apocalyptic vision and one which may turn into a violent vision. There is more apocalyptic violence around, so to speak, than we often realize, because apocalyptic violence becomes part of the mythology of death and rebirth. And in apocalyptic violence, one can feel oneself, if one is part of it, as allied to an eternal ethical principle. And indeed, one can see oneself as seeking spiritual improvement. These are some of the attractions that apocalyptic violence can have. Even in situations where we don't think in that direction, for instance, that of Timothy McVeigh in the bomb he exploded in Oklahoma City in 1995, killing 168 people, one thinks of him as a loner who was angry at his government. But it turns out that he had connections with radical religious groups, with Christian religious groups believing in apocalyptic violence. And his favorite volume was a notorious novel by a neo-Nazi called The Turner Diaries, which describes a revolution of the, quotes, white patriots against the government, which had become too soft on blacks and Jews. The revolution succeeds. The white patriots take over the government and the world, and the effects of the revolution are to annihilate, first in North America and then throughout the world, all non-whites and all Jews. That was McVeigh's favorite book, which he slept with under his pillow and gave away at gun shows, and it couldn't be more apocalyptic. When I assign that to students, I feel as though I'm assigning Mein Kampf with nuclear weapons. If one looks at the Israeli-Arab conflicts without going into it in detail, there's an apocalyptic dimension to each. For instance, Amir, the murderer of Rabin, in terms of Israeli extremism, not only wanted to prevent the peace process from taking hold, which he certainly did, but he felt he had to murder Rabin, as did others around him, because by giving away Jewish land, Rabin was delaying the appearance of the Messiah. Similarly, in some of the Hamas projection, again, Hamas's terrorism is not only for the sake of impeding the peace process, but for mounting a holy war that might destroy Israel and bring about an Islamist world. And there are various examples all through the world where what we see as ordinary violence has an apocalyptic dimension underneath it. And those who embrace apocalyptic violence feel themselves in touch with ultimate power, ownership of death. That was the case with Om Shinrikyo, the fanatical Japanese cult that I mentioned. This was a small cult, and there were only 1,400 people who were monks and worked directly with the guru, and yet they embraced what was called by the ancient Hebrews forcing the end. Ancient rabbis had debates, I'm told by authorities who wrote about this, in which they discussed whether it was acceptable to join in and further the violence that was thought to be necessary for the Messiah to appear. And fortunately, the rabbis decided in their wisdom that the such violence was heretical because only God could determine the pace of the appearance of the Messiah. But many groups today want to, so to speak, help God along by forcing the end, by actively contributing to Armageddon through their own violence. And that was the vision of Om Shinrikyo. Despite being Buddhist and in some degree Hindu, they embrace the Christian vision of Armageddon, and they're releasing sarin gas. They're releasing sarin gas and manufacturing biological weapons and seeking nuclear weapons unsuccessfully, it turned out. All were part of a vision of initiating World War III in order to bring about a biblical Armageddon. Of course, wild fantasy. but fantasy backed up by the production of weapons of mass destruction and an effort to acquire nuclear weapons. If one looks at bin Laden and asks, what does bin Laden want? Well, here I think the idea of apocalyptic violence helps us. Bin Laden is confusing to Americans because we see that he has political goals. He would like to bring America down, and he would certainly like to get America out of the Middle East. But there is something much more amorphous about bin Laden and al-Qaeda and Islamist radicalism in general. And this is the apocalyptic dimension that I'm speaking of. There is an impulse to destroy that part of the world which is non-Islamist or insufficiently Islamist in order to purify it and recreate as much of the world as possible in a pure Islamist image. That's why he issues fatwas and has focused on not only America, but America as an enemy, but America as a symbol of Western incursion. It's important to understand that the concept of jihad, as expressed by bin Laden and other Islamist militants, is not just an expression of holy war, which it certainly is, an advocacy of a holy war. It's also a religious and psychological concept. It includes a personal struggle to be a better father or daughter or husband or wife within an Islamist context, and a struggle to defend the truths of Islam as an individual. That, in a sense, deepens and renders more problematic the Islamist impulse toward holy war, because it's backed by this kind of psychological and immediate individual experience. And, of course, the martyrdom component, the suicidal element in Islamist militancy, can also deepen it, because it enables the individual, quotes, martyr, to act out with his own or her own body that mythic principle of death and rebirth, really the entire apocalyptic process. It makes the individual militant, it places him or her, as has been observed, as part of a sacred drama. It's important that the Islamist militancy that bin Laden and al-Qaeda represent tragically represents a major form of Islamic idealism. So it is a tragedy that so much of Islamist idealism is channeled into killing and mass killing. It doesn't mean that has to be a permanent kind of situation. There has been a concept in Islamist militancy of what's called the neglected duty, and the principle here is that Islamic leaders and intellectuals have neglected their duty to carry out a holy war. So there's a deep motivation to take on what had been one's neglected duty in an idealistic rejuvenation or revitalization of oneself and one's people. If one looks at these issues, and this is exactly, unfortunately, what our government discouraged us from doing, one has to look at some of the terrorist dynamic and motivation. I won't go into this in detail, just to suggest certain approaches. What seems to be at the fringe can have reverberations toward the center. I talked to people in Japan who had disapproved completely of Ohm's violence, Ohm Shinrikyo's violence, but said, one of them said to me, nonetheless, I feel very Ohm, meaning he felt identified with the radical critique of society that Ohm put forward. you can have reverberations at the center of society from what seems to be a fringe group. That was the situation with Amir, and who killed Rabin. There were rabbis in between who partly encouraged him, who gave signals for him to go ahead. And in the case of Hamas, though, they are close to the heart of Palestinian society, vying for the leadership of that society. And there are varying levels of influence and connections to the center that such militant groups can have. But even a group that seems at the fringe can touch nerves of antagonism and anger at those who are more centrist, so that there were many seemingly pro-Western Islamics who said, I don't approve of bin Laden's methods, but I sympathize with him or I admire him for standing up to America and standing up to the West. Bin Laden himself has emphasized centuries of humiliation on the part of Islamics, particularly at the hands of Western imperialism. He goes back to the Crusades, but certainly in the 19th and 20th centuries, there was a heavy hand of Western imperialism, which essentially carved out the Middle East into its present structure, notably on the part of England and France. And that humiliation he speaks of has been very real. Dennis Jordan, the American novelist and journalist who has spent some time in that part of the world, puts it this way: they hate us as people hate a bad God, and they'll kill themselves to hurt us. He's really speaking of how America has come to symbolize evil for Islamist radicalism, and of course there's the counterpart of their symbolizing evil for our administration. And with every example of American bellicose behavior, certainly in the invasion of Iraq, we create more terrorists, as though rendering more real this Islamist vision of civilizational and religious war. Again, the issue of humiliation, turning to America and America's war on terrorism. People are aware of what happened on that day, and it was a dreadful event. In Nuremberg terms, it was a crime against humanity, perpetrated by those who brought about 9/11. But what America experienced, among other emotions, was a strong sense of humiliation. Any major power so attacked would feel humiliated, all the more so a superpower. What I call the superpower syndrome is a sense of being the world's greatest power and a sense of entitlement thereby to control or rule much of the world, at least in terms of outcome of historical events. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. For a superpower to be successfully attacked, as at 9/11, was profoundly humiliating, and humiliation is a very painful emotion that can often be a source of violence. There's the humiliation of bin Laden that I mentioned. There's our own humiliation. There's the humiliation of the Nazis in a very different context. As Nazi doctors I spoke to told me about how they witnessed as children or heard from their fathers the humiliating scene of German soldiers returning defeated, the country in shambles after World War I, and how a reversal or a confrontation with that humiliation was central to Hitler and the Hitler movement in its rise to power. So humiliation can be a dangerous historical or psycho-historical emotion. In any case, the response to 9/11 on the part of our administration was immediately that of war. Bush was quoted by Woodward as saying, "We're at war," and Woodward called his book of the first 100 days, "Bush at War." There was never any sense that this was an act of terrorism which should be responded to as such. It would certainly require, inevitably, some kind of forceful response, but it was never considered to make that response focused and limited and internationalized. Rather, the response was unilateral and was declared to be a war. And there was talk about 80 countries fighting on fronts in 80 countries very quickly after 9/11. There was also the question of invading Iraq brought up immediately after 9/11, as has come out very clearly from within the administration in work by Richard Clark and Paul O'Neill and others. But the idea of a war on terrorism became an all-out enterprise without limits in time or place. It has been amorphous. It has touched upon infinity in our sense of entitlement concerning our war making. All this under the rubric of the war on terror. And in that sense, our own apocalyptic tendencies have been expressed by the war on terror. And at one point, Bush said, he said, at some point we may be the only ones left. That's okay with me. We are Americans. It's a kind of apocalyptic statement. The only ones left to make this decision, left in the world. In that sense, Bush is saying that we Americans are the anointed ones, and the mission to destroy and recreate is our mission. And in this and other ways, Islamist apocalypticism and American apocalypticism intertwine. And we do have, as you know, apocalyptic tendencies in our own culture. There is what can be called a military fundamentalism, the impulse from this administration in particular to solve all social and historical problems elsewhere through military rather than nonviolent or diplomatic means, along with an actual Christian fundamentalist impulse which can extend into one of an apocalyptic vision and apocalyptic violence. That's why Woodward, who wrote a very admiring book about Bush, though I hear that his new book about to come out is more critical, Woodward spoke of Bush as seeing himself as following God's master plan. God's master plan. It's an interesting paraphrase of Woodward's grasp of what Bush was doing, as though he was doing the work of God in this militaristic and apocalyptic worldview and mindset. And of course, surrounding him in his administration are many who have been associated with fundamentalist and apocalyptic visions, notably John Ashcroft, who tells us that our only king is Jesus. Bush himself, as you know, was saved from a self-destructive alcoholism by a conversion administered by Billy Graham, and has indicated tendencies of his own toward fundamentalism and certainly a religiosity that colors everything he does. He's a man on a mission, says, I'm in the Lord's hands. That's the reason why I'm here. So this has to do with evoking an American potential for the apocalyptic, which is enormously intensified by our superpower syndrome. The superpower readily, when it's in the superpower syndrome I'm describing, readily takes on an apocalyptic mission, seeing itself as the determinant in world history. And, of course, that's expressed in some of the language of Bush and his administration, the axis of evil, the polarization of the world, and the sense of destroying and annihilating or capturing every single terrorist in the world as a means of eliminating evil. It's a very simplistic idea. The truth is you can't destroy terrorism. Terrorism is not an enemy. It's a tactic. And you can neither destroy terrorism, because it will remain as a tactic. You can try to isolate those who engage in terrorism by wise policies. And you certainly can't eliminate evil. But Bush has pictures of the leading terrorists in the world so identified, and he crosses out their picture in this list that he keeps on his desk when somebody is killed or captured. So that is the American apocalyptic intensified by the superpower syndrome, again interacting with the Islamist apocalyptic. It's a kind of dance of death, as I call it, and in a way, Bin Laden and Saddam Hussein are Bush's best friends. Of course, they're adversaries to him, but they represent an active part of a dynamic by which he can claim to be fighting the war on terrorism and protecting America and Americans. Ironically, though, the superpower feels indeed vulnerable and is perhaps the most fearful nation on Earth. Americans are not good at vulnerability. We have had the protection of our oceans, and Bush is fond of saying these days that we no longer have it. We have had the idea of American exceptionalism, that we are a special people, blessed in many ways, and whose wars and outcomes are always good. And now, though, with the superpower syndrome, the idea of profound vulnerability is unacceptable. The superpower is meant to be omnipotent. It possesses more than ordinary power. That's why we call it a superpower. And, of course, nuclear weapons are a key to the superpower status, and we certainly dominate the world in terms of our nuclear stockpile. But nuclear weapons are also a vulnerability, because nuclear proliferation is a reality, and psychologically we encourage that proliferation by not taking steps to radically diminish or eliminate our own stockpiles, which are incidentally required by international law according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And as we then set our policies, often violent policies, toward eliminating this proliferation, which we do fear and which is a danger, it is an aspect of a continuing dynamic of vulnerability while encouraging the very thing that we fear, the nuclear proliferation, by our policies and by our own renewed and rampant nuclearism. Our, in this case, being the Bush administration, because, as you know, ever since the beginning of the nuclear age, beginning with Truman, every American president has been deeply ambivalent about nuclear weapons. He has said these weapons may have to be used because they're part of our arsenal at one time, and at another time has said these weapons are unusable. They are too dreadful in what they do to human beings. There's no such ambivalence in this administration. Rather, it looks for more, quotes, creative uses of nuclear weapons, such as bunker busters or other forms of low-yield nuclear weapons. And in that sense, it contributes to this dangerous dynamic of potential use of the weapons on our part and creating the motivation and the stimulus for other countries to engage in nuclear proliferation and acquire the weapons themselves. So more than any other nation, we're bedeviled by fear and by a sense of vulnerability. In my work, I've done a lot about the psychology of survivors, and without going into that in detail either, I want to say that you can't understand this administration without looking at what they take to be their survivor mission. And here you can look at both Vietnam and 9/11. One of the American, a survivor mission has to do with the need of survivors for meaning. When you undergo a death encounter or an immersion in death, you need to feel some meaning of what you've been through, of that catastrophe, if you are to feel meaning in the rest of your life. And survivors translate that meaning very often into a survivor mission. A survivor mission in political terms for many on the right, and certainly this neoconservative group that created the invasion of Iraq, their survivor mission to Vietnam and the loss of that war was to reassert American power in the world and to do it with new energy and new belligerence. Then with 9/11 and that survival came the potential for releasing that power in the war on terrorism that I mentioned. So the war on terrorism became the survivor mission of George Bush and his entourage. And it gave a new meaning to his administration and to his presidency. As you know, before that, he was considered a very lackluster president, even criticized by people around him. He came to life, took on new energy with 9/11, as he made the war on terrorism his survivor mission. And he talked about it in many ways as the true meaning of his administration and as what his administration would stand or fall on. One has to realize that in psychological terms, while rage or belligerence can be a difficult emotion to sustain, the experience of loss and pain and grief or guilt are much more painful emotions. And the death anxiety that accompanied surviving 9/11, both particularly in immediate survivors who had the most extreme and primal forms of grief, but for the rest of us as well, that survivor experience has been about death anxiety and efforts to convert death anxiety into something else. Unfortunately, this administration into forms of belligerent war making. What America seeks is what I call fluid world control. There's much talk about empire now, and that talk is relevant. One has to look at the model of the British Empire, and there are parallels and parallels in resistance right there in Iraq. Rather than have large numbers of bureaucrats of our own on the ground, we seek to control the outcome of historical events. And this is a form of fluid world control, a form of ownership of history, as I call it. In some ways, it's more dangerous than traditional empire building, but as in the case of traditional empire building, it must fail. It's based on a fantasy of world control that can never be realized. And the claim becomes inevitably Orwellian, as the wonderful writer James Carroll tells us, defense becomes offense, the protection of your children becomes the murder of another's, his threat becomes your preemption. You kill to stop the killing. Then you wonder, are you the victim or the slayer? But you are both. This is what Albert Camus meant when he warned us to be neither victims nor executioners. There's also a quest for absolute security. And of course, that's another mirage or kind of fantasy. The term, ironically, was developed by no less than Henry Kissinger, who warned us against it in relation some years ago in relation to revolutionary behavior. One has to see as the reasons for the invasion of Iraq this effort at fluid world control. The reasons given, all of which have some relevance, disarmament of weapons of especially weapons of mass destruction, which of course turned out not to exist, though we were afraid of them, the need for, quotes, regime change, and the idea of democratizing the entire Middle East, and of course the reason given by opponents of the war to acquire oil, which was very relevant. But all of these should be seen as subsumed to our quest for fluid world control, and Iraq is a key nation as Bush's advisors have written over the past 10 years, a key nation for control of the resources and the area of the Middle East. It's part of the ownership of history. All these then can be seen as aspects of the superpower syndrome, which is, in my view, a disorder or a confluence of behavior patterns, or what's called a concurrence of symptoms. And that's why I use this medical metaphor to describe our situation. Of course, it's a highly destructive syndrome, not only to others, but ultimately to oneself. And yet, in my concluding remarks, to return to Iraq and to express other directions, let me make just a few further comments. I mentioned the drumbeat of American deaths in Iraq. There are two kinds of survivor experience of meaning and mission in relation to those American deaths. The traditional survivor mission, which the president and the people around him espouse, is to say, we must not have let them die in vain. Therefore, we pursue the war ever more fiercely and do, as the president said in his press conference, the work of the fallen. But there's also an alternative survivor mission, which has been abroad in various parts of the world since Homer, which is more critical, and questions for its meaning the nature of the mission itself, and comes to the conclusion that the deaths were not justified, that they did die in vain, and that the proper meaning and mission is to prevent additional people from dying in vain. Now, this was the survivor mission that took hold in relation to Vietnam. And there's a psychological interplay, as I've mentioned before, between those returning from Vietnam, those returning from Iraq, and in some degree the American public, because there are again two levels of survivor: those families who feel the most immediate and overwhelming grief, families of soldiers killed, and the rest of us, who are survivors at a distance but nonetheless experience survivor emotions. So that alternative survivor mission could take hold still further. You have the feeling of more news coming through every day about Americans dying and of a belated concern that's beginning to emerge of Iraqis killed, and a lot of them have been killed. I think America is now caught between these two survivor missions, but there is a tradition which will emerge ever more strongly, and it needs our help in this process. And one sees it in the literature of World War I as well as Vietnam for this alternative survivor mission. We're capable of stepping out of the superpower syndrome, of regaining or reclaiming our moral compass, and I argue that to do so would relieve us of a great burden, because we're on a treadmill. We're committed to controlling the outcome of history, and we're not able to do that. I think of us as a Sisyphus with bombs. Sisyphus, you know, was condemned mythologically to push a stone, a heavy stone, up a hill, and he could never quite get the stone up to the top of the hill. That's what our superpower syndrome places us in, that kind of situation, at a time that there's a decline in the nation state and its legitimacy. We plunge in and claim a legitimacy that is not ours all over the world. But I say this in a spirit of hope, because I think we have traditions and capabilities of stepping out of this syndrome, and there are signs that many people share this view. Now, there is a problem here in terms of the need to feel compassion for survivors and victims, and that's been a leitmotif of much of my work. But there's also a danger of what can be called exaggerated victim consciousness. When I went to Hiroshima some years after I did my study there and talked to survivor leaders there, They said they were worried about exaggerated victim consciousness in atomic bomb survivors because some of them became so obsessed with their own victimization that they could think of nothing else and were immobilized. And one way of resolving that feeling was to arrange for meetings between Hiroshima survivors and survivors of the Holocaust and other catastrophic events to universalize and share in a universalized sense of suffering. There's a danger of exaggerated victim consciousness in the United States so that the superpower can see itself as the most aggrieved and the most victimized by 9/11. One has to recognize, and of course that exaggerated victim consciousness can lead to the sense of entitlement of the superpower syndrome as the two interact with each other. But in all this, to overcome that, we have to surrender the claim of certainty, of ownership of truth, or ownership of reality. There's a wonderful Catholic theologian, David Tracy, who wrote a book called Plurality and Ambiguity, and made the argument that all great spiritual leaders had ambiguity and a sense of doubt in achieving their faith. And of course, instead of refusing to nuance, as the president puts it, we have to nuance more and recognize ambiguity as a central issue in world and individual life. I write about this in my ideas about the protean or many-sided self as potentially open, but I won't go into that now. This means, of course, accepting the fact that we die, that we are mortals, rejecting the idea that we are gods, as Camus also says. Camus advocates a philosophy of limits, and as he puts it, he who does not know everything cannot kill everyone. And finally, in closing, I want to stress that survivors can either close down or open out. When they close down, they become stuck in their psychic numbing and in fantasies of revenge. When they open out, they can find some kind of illumination, some sort of knowledge about life and death and human experience through that death encounter. That holds for us as a people. We can close down and remain bent on revenge and killing, or we can open out and seek to grasp the source of our pain and of our crisis and take steps that diminish rather than increase the world's violence. And finally, I'll close with two quotations because it's the poets who say these things best. The first is more than 2,000 years old. It comes from Seneca, the Roman philosopher and statesman and dramatist, and he wrote, "Power over life and death, don't be proud of it. Whatever they fear from you, you'll be threatened with." And finally, the American lyric poet Theodore Rutke, whom I've been quoting for generations, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see." Thank you very much.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton speaking in 2004 at the Madison Institute. Thanks to the L.A. Sound Posse, lasoundposse.org, David Rovics, davidrovics.com, Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters, and the Madison Institute of Wisconsin for their contributions to this program. You can download a copy of this and previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.